Good morning, everyone. Hope you're all doing well. We are in a difficult and challenging time for the Jewish people, historically, especially this time of year. And the stories that are coming out of the news in recent weeks have, to anyone who's got any form of spiritual ears, should be quite alarmed at the various stories that we are hearing coming out of the news involving our people, the Jewish people. It's well worth maybe delving into a little bit of what our sages have said over the millennia that we've been a people to try to maybe find some kind of, I won't say consolation, but something that can maybe lift us up and to put some spiritual angle, more than just the pontificating of the journalists and political pundits as to why we are where we are in the Jewish year. So as you'll know, next week will be Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av. And the 9th of Av, we're going to see, commemorates a specific event that happened to our people. But we're going to see that it goes back. There is something deep inside our people that goes back all the way to the biblical times, to the time of the Torah, when the Jewish people left Mitzrayim, Egypt, and are about to enter into the land of Israel. What about note one? Everyone have their sheets on them? Hi, Alan. Okay. Just make sure. Thank you so much. So we know the Jewish people were about to enter into the land, and they came upon the idea of sending in spies. 12 spies were selected to go in and to spy out the land. Of course, 10 came back with a negative report about what happened and what was happening in the land itself. And seemingly sending the spies itself may well have been a bad decision. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God turned around to Moshe Rabbeinu and said, since you spent 40 days in the land, there's going to be b'mispar hayamim asher tatem et haaretz arba'im yom, yom l'shana, yom l'shana tisu et avonoteichem arba'im shana. We were decreed, say Chazal, to 40 years in the Midbar. 40 years, they say, is about the time of a generation. That entire generation were wiped out. And their children were allowed into the land itself. The Talmud has a very interesting insight into the reaction of the Jewish people when they had this bad report. And the Talmud in the Tractate of Ta'anit famously says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as it were, spoke to the Jewish people and had something to say about their response. Atem b'chitem b'chia shalchinam, you, the Jewish people, you cried for no reason. What was the no reason over here? And this, of course, was the no reason that they didn't have faith in God, that they were going to enter the land of Israel and feel safe. They felt this was a suicide mission. Since they did not have the necessary emunah, faith in God at that time, and cried all night, says Hashem, says God, V'ani kovel lachem b'chil doros. There's going to be a certain mida keneged mida, measure for measure. You, the Jewish people, decided en masse to cry all night when you heard what the spies told you. They spoke wrongly about the land of Israel. Lashon hara, they spoke evil speech about the land itself. Not about a person, per se. The land itself was spoken about in a negative manner, something we have to be careful of even in our day. So I'm going to set something in motion. From now on, that night, which our sages tell us was actually the ninth of the month of Av, is going to be a time of perpetual crying right through history. So this is going to be, I mean, I don't know how to really express it in English, but maybe there's a negative spiritual energy that goes around in the year. The word shana, as we know, which means year, also means to repeat. All right, lechem mishum, which is a double lechem, right? Double bread we have on Friday on Shabbos. So too, there is a repeating of the year, and this is going to be a repetitive, painful time, a time of mourning in the Jewish year. And the Mishnah in Ta'anit specifies four specific times that have led to much crying on that night. There were five things that happened to our ancestors on Tisha B'Av, that which started the spies. Number one, Nigzar al Avasim Shalom Yichasu La'aretz. Number one, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God decreed upon our ancestors, they would not be able to enter into the land. Two, the first temple was destroyed. three over Shnea, and the second temple was destroyed as well. That's what most of our lamenting on Tisha B'Av is about. Or Nilchadar Beitar, there was a very strong city called Beitar, which was home to a strong and powerful Jewish community in terms of learning and physically as well. And a number of years after the temple was destroyed, this temple was destroyed as well. Nechashair, and many years later, Jerusalem on the 9th of Av, the sages tell us, was plowed over as well. Just so we don't think that our focus of commiseration is merely on those five could well be enough. That's probably hundreds of thousands of lives, Jewish lives, were lost on that time as well. Bar Barbanel, Don Isaac Barbanel, lived in Spain in the 1400s, says that if you look carefully through history, there's many such examples, but this is a very, very powerful piece I brought out, because if you look through Jewish history, we're going to see this year, this date, rather, within the year, has a certain negative vibe that's going to carry on for Doros. And he is speaking about, of course, the exile of the Jewish people in 1492, which is when, as you all know, we learned in school, Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue. And by the way, there were Jews on board. There was a theory that Christopher Columbus was Jewish. There was an article written by a friend of mine, fairly recently hit one of the Jewish papers, whether he was or wasn't. And he lost his way, which is maybe reminiscent of a Jewish driver. But one thing we can say is that there definitely were Jews on board. And they say that they seem to have some kind of physical evidence, logs that were put in and written on board. And there were some Hebrew letterings, maybe a Beis HaAvdalah, the Tziad HaShemayah, what Jewish people write on top of pages, that were actually in the logs. So there definitely were some Jews on board. It makes sense. They're being kicked out. What better way is to jump on board with Christopher, and you never know where you're going to end up. Says the Abarbanel, and he obviously had a very high position. I believe he was the financial guardian for Ferdinand and Isabella at that time. And actually, he was offered to stay in Spain. Remember, Spain was the was the America of its day, you know. The fact that the Jewish people are running the finances shouldn't surprise us too much. But they offered him to stay at the time, and he refused. Okay, they weren't stupid enough to kick out their leading accountant. And he says like this, Uvobi Yom Nase Grush Tsarfat. Happens to be, he says, that on July 30th, 1492, there was the removal of the Jewish people in France. And he says, it shouldn't surprise you. There have been many exiles and pogroms and holocausts that have happened to our people at this time. Vihine. When there was a decree against here in Spain, he's speaking, they were given a 3-month window to leave, which actually ended, we're going to see, on Tisha B'Av. Okay? It was actually the 9th of Av, that was the final day. The Jewish people, I believe, I read, the Jewish people were actually on the borders of Spain on the 9th of Av, ready to be removed. And he's saying, I believe, that the Spanish king didn't realize, he didn't plan this whole thing around Tisha B'Av, he's saying. He didn't know, you know what, what's a bad time for Jewish people? Let's go through the calendar. When's the most inconvenient time? Like Erev Pesach or something, I don't know. Instead, he's saying, and his beautiful words, I brought it down to these words, Ke'ilu min ha-shamayim hidrichuhu. It's seemingly, he says, from heaven, that the king of Spain was led, his mind was taken over, as it were, and God decided that this date would be the date that he would use to remove the Jewish people. And note four, those who are following, Mikvelos as Manahu, and it had been determined in heaven that they would be kicked out at this time. Okay. So the Talmud tries to find, it gives political reasons why the Second Temple was destroyed. We're going to go back to the Second Temple. That seems to be the focus of, for some reason, the destruction of the temple seems to be the start of the snowball down the mountain and the catalyst that led to so many other terrible things in Jewish history. So the Talmud focuses on political reasons, but as we said, we, the Jewish people, to this day, are always looking internally for spiritual reasons why bad things happen to us. And the Talmud does that for us and says the following. Aval mikdash sheni. In the second temple, she'oskim b'Torah mitzvahs u'gemilas chasadim. The Jews of that time, said, make no mistake, they were, on the surface, very religious people. They were learning Torah. They were involved in doing mitzvahs. And not only things between them and Hashem, the first two, and they were involved in doing chasadim. They were doing acts of kindness. If you'd have stopped off at your local charity house, there were Jews there who were being cared for, who were being tended to. The charity coffers, we can assume, were full. People were being tended to fully. There was mitzvahs being adol v'makom between us and God, Torah mitzvahs, and between us and each other. So what happened? How could that lead to this? Mipnei ma'charav. So then what reason, the Talmud asks, was the destruction? And maybe we can look to future such troubles and calamities to maybe find a similar spiritual route, which we're going to do. Mipnei shaita bo sinas chinam. The Talmud says very famously, there was hatred. But not only was there hatred between each other, this was chinam. It wasn't based upon anything. Chinam means free. But it wasn't based upon anything rational, nothing to put your finger on. It was just hatred. Okay? Lametcha. And therefore, this comparison between these three big things, Torah, mitzvahs, and gemilat chasadim, okay, doing Torah, doing mitzvahs, and acts of kindness, we, or the Talmud, is saying we can make a connection between that and sinat chinam, and needless and baseless hatred, and that sinat chinam, hating each other, is equal to the three of the worst aveirot, three of the worst sins, avodah zarah, which was idol worship, gili arayos, forbidden sexual relationships, ushlichas damim, and murder. So the Talmud is picking out these three, saying maybe the Jewish people were not involved in these things. They were by the first time, not the second temple. However, we can find something which, for some reason, and I mean, I've heard this as a child, but we still have to chew it over, you know? How could it be that hating someone else and not necessarily doing anything per se, you're not killing them, you're not worshipping idols, right? You're not withholding charity from them. But there's something about this internal hatred that exists among our people, which the spiritual world looks down upon us and is not pleased, to put it in the least. And recently, the Chafetz Chaim spoke on this, and he adds an extra idea to this, which we won't be going into, but it's worth mentioning because the Chafetz Chaim speaks, right? It's worth listening to. Israel Meir Kagan. He was a Cohen, as you'll know, who lived in Europe pre-World War II. And he says, L'Sofia may besar sheni. Right to the end of the Second Temple, Gavra sinas chinam. There was a strong growth in hatred. V'lashon hara. And he adds something else, which I guess we can see is connected, and malicious and destructive speech is really what it is, actually. Destructive speech between people. Beinenu, between us being the Jewish people. And this happened, and our many sins were formed upon this. And because of this, Necharav HaBayis, the temple was destroyed. Chofetz Chaim has no problems using the Gemara and adding an addendum, saying that, and he has a lot of precedent to base this upon, that there was also evil speech. And he's linking the two together. And don't be surprised that we were kicked out of our land because. And he quotes the Talmud from Yoma and the Yerushalmi, and he says that Sinas Chinam, as we quoted a moment ago, was the reason why this happened. Bakavaya Loshon Haragam, he's saying also speech. Ken Shiyotzat and Sarasina, you see, speech comes out because of hatred. Actually, hatred's main manifestation rarely is murder, but more so is speech. And according to the Chofetz Chaim, of course, it's famous for saying that speech can be murder. Okay, as we all learned, sticks and stones may break our bones, words may never hurt me. Chofetz Chaim disagreed with that little saying we used to say as children. Seemingly, speech itself is a killer. So the question is, we're on note 7. What exactly has that got to do with us? Okay, so you know what? I'll be involved in those three, okay? And I will try to do Torah mitzvahs, and maybe I'll work on Sinas Chinam. So in other words, we're looking at a historical reality, and a person could say that. They could say, you know what's happened a couple thousand years ago? What's it going to do with me? Right? I can look at this sociologically, I can look at it, anthropologically, and psychologically. They had problems. Right? We're very good at doing that, right? They had problems, but it's all okay with me, Jack. I'm okay. And the Talmud doesn't let us get away with that. The Talmud says, Kol dor v'dor, in case you think that this was their problem and we are mere academics, so why was the Second Temple destroyed all those years ago? The political reality, that's not the way the Jewish people look at those events. The fact that the temple, says the Talmud, has not been rebuilt means there's something incumbent upon every generation that did not rebuild it, that we are keeping it in a state of destruction. That's what the Talmud says. Kol dor v'dor shelo nivna beis hamikdash, did not rebuild the third temple, b'yamav, during the days, mala akosav, the Torah, akosav refers to the writings of the Torah, i.e., God, considers it ki'ilu hu echrivu. It's as though they destroyed it. Ergo, right, when we are involved in the, let's go to the positive just a moment, when we are involved in positive spiritual reality, as my Rebbe used to say when I was a kid in yeshiva, 8 or 9 year old, he would say every mitzvah is another brick in the wall of the Beis Hamikdash. Used to teach you to say that to you when you were kids, right? Well, it's a good thing to hear. Every mitzvah you do, I never really got about that. Looking back, he was saying something good. This is the flip side to that. If we in our generation do not rebuild it, we are as culpable as our ancestors were when in their days it was destroyed. We're not left the hook. This is not a history class. Okay? We're not describing the temple's destruction as a historical reality. We are deeply involved. We are just the continuation of those Jews back then. Let's have a look at one more source, and then we'll do the meat of our discussion, the remaining 20 minutes. The Chasam Sofer says something very interesting in the Pesach Haggadah, and I bring it down for a separate reason which we can learn out from this very interesting piece. Says the Chasam Sofer, Shema Tomar, maybe a person will say, Merachnanu, what Rebach, the Yetzir Mitzrayim, did we get by leaving Egypt? Strange question that is. Right? And he's speaking on his commentary on the Haggadah, the book we read on Passover, on Pesach. He's like, what's the point of leaving Egypt? Why? Like, that wasn't a particularly nice place to be. V'anachnu v'gola, because we're still in exile. Right? We are in, according to Jewish tradition, the fourth. Oh, I did read a couple of years ago that we're possibly in the fifth exile, not much spoken about. The year of Chaim Vital, student of the Arizal, brings down on his commentary on Sefer Tehillim, and I have this piece at home, a wild piece actually, shown to me by Rosh Hashiva, that there will be a fifth galut, a fifth exile. Right? We know there's four exiles. Fourth is Edom, the one we've been in, the Roman exile, if you will, which is kind of the Christian one, over the past couple of thousand years. He brings down quite famously that we are actually possibly in a fifth one, which he calls the one of Adam, the galut of Adam. Anyone heard this before? It's a wild piece. Adam. So who's Adam in the Torah? Who's he referring to? He's referring to the Para-Adam, which is the description for Yishmael. And he says, you know, he says, that you are near the end of days when you see the Yishmaelim, the nations that come, we assume it to be the Arab nations, seem to have control, have risen up, which is fairly recently, actually, if you look at historically, have risen up in our generation, I'm saying, and to take over and cause much hardship to the world and the Jewish people. And he says, because of that, you know, you are near the end. So whichever you look at, whether we're in the fourth, end of the fourth, or in the fifth galut, fifth exile, what's the point of getting out of Egypt? We should have just stayed there. Why did God take us out? I mean, give him a word for us. You know, it's out of the, what's the expression? Out of the frying pan to the fire? Is that the expression? Okay, something like that. Okay. Ella, Shabbat, this is wild, by the way. This is an amazing principle, which we have to hear and we have to realize. There's something different about the exile we're in today. And what is that? In the exile from Egypt, we couldn't bring closer the end. In other words, this is true for all the exiles the Jewish people have been in. There was always a set time that was given to every hardship we have given to. Now, we didn't always know that time. Sometimes we did. For example, when the Jewish people were in Persia, between the destruction of the first temple and the rebuilding of the second temple, where the whole Purim story kicks in, we knew from the prophets of the time that there would be a 70-year galut. We knew that galut would last 70 years. It was a known thing. Actually, the Talmud of Megillah says, I'm learning this, that not only did the Jewish people know that, but the non-Jewish nations knew that as well. Achashverosh knew that the Jewish people would be only 70 years. Right? Belshazzar, who perceived in him, also knew it would be for 70 years. Vashti, we're told, knew it would be for 70 years. Why is that important? And by the way, if they were so sure, how come they didn't predict the real end? So they knew it would be 70 years, but they didn't know the start and end point. Okay? Ahasuerus made a calculation. That, and it was based upon when the Jews left, when the last Jews left, when the Torah scrolls left. They made various calculations, and he made a mistaken calculation that the third year of his reign, Ahasuerus, would be the end of the 70 years. Which is why the opening scene of the Megillah is on the third year of Ahasuerus' reign. When he assumed it was the end of the 70 years, i.e. the Jewish people was thinking they were going to go back to the land of Israel, he was like, you're not going back. Welcome to your new home. My name is Ahasuerus. We're now in the third year. Shalom HaMelech. He was now seated well on his throne, doesn't mean physically. That means he now took his throneship in a much higher standing. The Jewish people, it's over, you're not going back. That's why he put on the big day kahuna. They say, tell the people, this is your new Jerusalem. Okay. He was wrong. He miscalculated by a number of 17, is that right? Something like that. He miscalculated. So that every galut, every exile, always has a definite beginning and end. Okay, there's machloket, argument when that beginning and end starts or finishes, but it's always fixed. Our galut, however, is the only exile that has no determined end. Maybe that's not the right word. Has no guaranteed end. In other words, there is an end that we know has to happen by a certain time, which is called ve'ito. Everything we're going through is going to end at a certain point, and the Mashiach will come, third temple will be rebuilt, and we'll be in a new spiritual reality. But we are given a very unusual power, which our ancestors did not have. What's that? Through our actions, we are able to bring closer the end of our troubles. That's a very interesting thing. That means we, right, the latter people in Jewish history, which pretty much everyone agrees we are at this point, we have the ability through our actions to make the end come very closely. Right? As was very famously sung, just one Shabbos and we'll all be free. I would sing it, but I'd have a good voice. Just one Shabbos, what's the idea? That's based on a Talmud that says, keep Shabbos. And it could be you can bring the end closer. And there's many different opinions. I'm going to bring a different opinion over here. That if we act the way we're meant to be acting, we can bring it closer. The Jews in Egypt didn't have that ability. 2:10 will start. Right? There's nothing they could have done. They had to go through it. When it came to Persia, they had to go through the 70 years. We, however, have that ability. Ella, Shubagalus Mitzrayim Le'echalu L'Degalat HaKeitz. Shubagalus Zeh, he says, he's speaking about our galut. B'yadeinu, it's in our hands. L'karev et HaKeitz, to bring close to the end. Our troubles could be diminished. Al Yadei, by doing what? Tzedakah, acts of kindness, of charity. U'masim Tovim, and good deeds. So he chooses those specific things. He could have said many things, by the way, but he chose those two specific examples. Lufikach, that's why. And then he brings down a verse from Haggadah, which he's actually commenting on. Kol dichven yesev yechal. Whoever is poor, come and eat, as we say in the case of Haggadah, right? That's always the thing. Pesach table is open to everyone. Why do we say it at that point? He says, v'nizkel l'shana haba, because by doing that, by opening our table to strangers, to come to our Passover Seudah, to have a meal, what we're actually doing is connecting to how we finish the Pesach Haggadah by saying, Shana Haba, B'Yerushalayim, Shana Haba, B'Yerushalayim. He is saying, I'm not going to sing anymore, that those two concepts are connected. If we are good to our fellow brethren among the Jewish nation, we next year will be in Jerusalem. He says the Haggadah is hinting at that reality. We have that power. Okay, so what I've decided to choose for the remaining 15 minutes we have together is one particular trait which I believe is deeply rooted in Sinat Chinam, baseless hatred, and Lashon Hara, okay, and most of our interpersonal relationships. So basically we're seeing though that the rabbis, all of them historically, right to this day, have based the continued calamities and destruction upon the Jewish people on mitzvos bein Adam l'chaveru, between us and each other. They don't seem to pick on too much mitzvah between us and Hashem. We seem to be able to get away in our misbehavior between us and God, Right? Which actually, you would have thought the other way around. Right? You would have thought we would get away with our misbehavior between us and God if we behave well towards each other. But if we don't behave well to each other and treat others in malicious ways by speech or action, as we're going to see, so too God judges us badly or worse than just any relationship with Him, and that leads to destruction. So the key over here is how we refer to in the Jewish world as midot, right? Midos, right? Or mida, the way we do character. It's a very interesting word. That what does the word actually literally mean? I mean, we refer to it as character traits, but what does the word literally mean? What's a mida? It's a measurement, right? A physical measurement, right? There's a mida to this table that's behind me. Everything has a physical measurement. Why do you think, it's a great question to think about at least once in your life, why do you think that the rabbis chose the word for a measurement to be exactly the same as the word for character traits?
Measure
of the man. That's one answer. Actually, we're going to see it goes both ways. Measure of the man and woman, right? That how do we measure how a person is doing? We look at their character traits. At a funeral, if anyone's had the misfortune of being at one, I've had to perform with you and attended many more, obviously, they don't speak too much about the fantastic house the man or woman had in Florida, or the great cars he drove, or the fantastic cigars. They talk about the chesed. Right? How do you, and even in England, we say, how does a person measure up? Right? How do they measure up to that thing? Right? When you got, you know, in the dating world, the question always asked the shabkan or someone setting up, what are their midot like? And what are the midos like? Right? I mean, they don't need physical measurements, right? Are they 6'4"? Right? Well, we know how tall is he? Well, he's Jewish, he's probably 5'3", but he's not asking about his measurements, right? Well, that comes later on, unfortunately. They want to know what's his character like? Right? How does he measure up as a person? How does he measure up in his life? Right? How do we Jews measure people? Right? Not in their height, thank goodness, maybe their girth, but we measure them in the way they treat and respect each other. I had a beautiful idea for one of my teachers many years ago. It also works the other way. And this is more pertinent to what we're describing over here. Imagine, I'm blessed with some children. One of my daughters comes in with mud on her shoes, which happens. And I say, Racheli, leave your shoes by the door, wipe them well, don't walk around the house with muddy shoes and boots. Okay, take them off. And I walk away, I come back, you know, 20 minutes later, and there are little miniature mud footprints around the house, okay? And I look at my daughter, I'm like, I told you not to do that. She's like, oh, sorry, Abba, I forgot. And I'm like, that's it. I'm done, okay? I told you, take your shoes off. No medical school for you. That's it. You know, we had a whole thing saved up. I'm spending that. Me and your mother, we're going to Florida with your medical school money. It's all over. Now, my 7-year-old will be like, hello? Okay, but to anyone else, I'll be like, that's ridiculous. You can't take away her medical school fund, right? Because she walked around. Why not? She did something wrong, agreed? I gave her a punishment. But the punishment does not fit the crime. Okay, the way I responded to my 7-year-old walking in my muddy boots, you can put it to bed early, no cookie for dinner, after dinner, whatever it is, you know, but the punishment has to fit the crime. What that means is the way I react to challenges in my life need to be measured. They need medida. Right? If somebody wrongs me in a certain way, it applies more than just to children. It applies to us, the adult children that we all are, right? It applies to us as well, that when we respond to some negativity that has come our way, we have to measure our response. Our characters are going to be based upon how we measure our response. And that really defines a person's midot. It's just a two-way street. Yeah? We have to, how does a person measure up in terms of their, way they react act to people, and also how we react, right? So it needs to be measured. And the one trait I want to work on today for a few minutes is something which I know I'm always struggling with, and that is anger. Kas, which the rabbis seem to be obsessed with, right? And there's so much written on this one thing. As a side point, by the way, whenever I talk about the character of anger in Torah sources, Hashem always organizes it that I'll lose my temper the next day. So if you see me tomorrow, don't come near me because I'm going to lose it with you, okay? I'm just reading the sources. This does not reflect upon me in any way, shape, or form. But maybe if we learn, we'll try to get a little bit better. Says the Orach HaTzaddikim, which is a fantastic book, which I've learned through a number of times. And this is really goes through all character traits, positive and negative, and puts them side by side. And he has a lot to say about this trait of anger. And he says, B'nei Adam, k'shein ko'asim machzikim b'kasim, when a person's very angry and holds on to their anger. That's an interesting expression. Einim shayimim libam akol ma'asim. We don't know what we're doing. There's a time when we lose it, as even the expression is good in English. V'oisim harbein miyan b'kasim, and we do a lot with our anger. Mashaloi yuosim b'lokas, that which I would not have done had I not been in a state of anger. Now remember, let's focus on our key points here. We're talking about sinas chinam, needless hatred, lashon hara was brought down, doing acts. I believe that anger, based upon the source we're going to look at, is tied in inexplicably. Right? We speak bad to others. We speak gossip about other people when we feel an anger towards them somewhere deep down. It may not be even a visible anger, right? What's it called? A passive anger, I think they call it. It's inside us, right? We're holding on to it, he says. And when we do, we're not accountable for our actions. And we, the Jewish people, need to be held in account for our actions. Ki akas motzi sichel shel adam. The best way to translate this is, it makes you nuts. When you're angry, you go crazy. Anyone here lost their temper? Don't need to tell me. Right? You know the things we say, and we're like, I can't believe I did that. Od acha marbe divrei akas, until it comes out, the nichlas machlokes, and we enter into anger, into our argument, contradiction, and into challenges with other people. Turn over to note 10. An incredible piece over here. And this is the smug, Satan Mitzvah like a Hagothic. And he says something amazing. And I'll tell you why I bring it down. He says that imagine a person sitting down and they're cutting a piece of meat with their right hand. And as it happens, you cut a piece of meat, you cut your left hand. Okay. Would your left hand do the following? Stupid right hand, give it a slap. What were you thinking? Of course, that's ridiculous. The person walking down the street trips up with their right foot. With their left foot, kick their right foot in anger. And the answer is, no, if you saw a person do that, you'd think they are cuckoo, right? They've been drinking the wrong liquids, right? They've gone absolutely crazy. Why? Because it's one body. I'm in it together, right? We're in it to win it. I would never blame myself for anything. So the rabbis learn out from this one piece. I've heard my teachers say, Rav Noach Weinberg made a long drush on this one piece. And he says, if you really see the Jewish people as one nation, as one body, how could you ever hurt anyone else? If you see the whole world as really one unified soul, how could you ever hurt them? You're hurting yourself. It's as nonsensical as your left hand slapping your right hand because your right hand dropped something or cut something. Okay? That's how we have to view the world. And the more Naim Rav Nachum Twersky, Shekol Laila, and he tries to find how anger is the root of this. Shekol Laila, the Ace Alis and Shamos. At nighttime, we know we're told that our souls go up into the spiritual world. We're told that sleep is a 60th of death. Right? That percentage is used a number of times. And that percentage always represents, even like basar v'chalav, meat and milk, 60th is always used, right, to ascertain taste or not, whether we can eat something. That percentage is used a number of times. I think dreaming is 60th of prophecy. Sound familiar? Right, so why that particular percentage be used? That usually connotes that which goes from existence to non-existence. So he says, whenever our souls go up, right, when we taste just a little bit of death, there is a hand, some kind of spiritual hand, because it's not my hand, that writes down all the sins of the day. If a person had an angry heart, in that day, what does the hand write? That this person lost their temper. It doesn't write anything else. Right? One line is written if a person lost their temper that day. We judge day by day, and that is this person lost it. You know, it's an interesting thing I heard. It's a side point, just for one moment. You know, I heard this from someone very strong. We're very, very fortunate that we have days. Take for granted, we have one day, they have another day. God created the world that it's one long day, your entire lifetime, but it's not, it's broken up into days. So I heard from a spiritual giant in Eretz Israel. He said, that's a great chesed, goodness that God does for us, that if we mess up one day, yeah, we go to sleep, kind of like, it feels like we rubbed it out and we start a new day. Okay? We start a new day. It's like that was yesterday. If life was one long day, we'd constantly be living without one mistake. So it's a great thing. We have the ability, and maybe this is what's happening spiritually, that our souls go up and we go through the dry cleaners. Right? In Shemayim, our souls get a certain da'az. Ein asrich lechtob Yosef. Doesn't write anything else. Seemingly, he says that anger itself summarizes all the other sins that we have between each other. And a certain mashal analogy is given by Rabbi Yosef Gittilia, a certain Kabbalist, and he says, Lamar hakas dome. How do we, the Jewish people, see anger in relation to our negative traits in general, our yetzara? And he says, it's like a pirzah efnei haganav. It's like an open entry for a thief. That's the analogy he makes. Anger to the soul is like an open doorway or a crack that a thief can get into. Well, what's he talking about? And he says, Pirush, let me explain. That all the time the ore of the wisdom is shining, but guf is the body. You see, when our soul is in our body, it's like we have a strong security door that is holding us back. And everything is held back. Just to jump, he says, however, when a person loses their temper, however, you've opened the window for all the other negative traits to come in. Otherwise, everything follows anger. That seems to be the root of our troubles and all the other negative aspects of our personality come out. What let all those things rush out? And he says, that is anger. And turn over to note 13. So I'm just going to skip it to some drop if you don't mind. He says it would be ideal if we take the opposite of anger, and that's something that needs to be worked on. And that is, as they say in Hebrew, savlanut. You know, they say savlanut, right? When Israeli starts to lose it with another Israeli, like in traffic, they do this it could help, actually, right? He says we need to have sevel, something to work on. This is a trait that we can work on. Ki zeh shoresh kol hamidos. He says this idea of savlanut, having patience and creating and working on patience, is the root of all the midos, vamanucha, and rest, v'shoresh kol hamalos. And he says this is better than anything else. Okay? If anger is the negative, the positive is having patience and working on it. And Rav Volbin Ali Shor actually says, I won't do it inside, but he actually says that a person should spend a little bit of time during the day. You know, most of us are praying during the day anyway at certain points. Maybe moments of that prayer, 15 minutes he recommends, could be spent in some kind of meditation, you know, to work through ourselves before we start to lose our composure with other people. And the Shlach Kadosh definitely agrees with him. Let's turn to note 16. We have exactly 2 minutes left on the clock. So if you don't mind, I'll bring down a little Kabbalah. The Baal HaTanya says the following. That's note 16 on the back page. And he says, the Talmud says very famously, Kol HaKoes, whoever loses their temper, Ke'ilu Oved Akum. It's as though they have served idols. A strong metaphor, right? Comparison to make. He's saying that, spiritually speaking, they've done one and the same. And he says the reason for this is when a person gets angry, they lose their emunah, they lose their belief, their faith in God. It departs from them. And everything around them, and they believe that everything happens, which usually a person believes comes from God, at that point, right, if they really believe that, they will get angry. In other words, the way we should see life is when that person comes in front of me in traffic, when the person I work with drives me crazy and makes me stay an extra hour or whatever it is, when my workmate disses me or embarrasses me and I want to get angry, he's saying, how should a person see that? A person should see that as coming from God. God is speaking to me via this person. That doesn't mean this person is blameless. Right? They need to still be taken to task in the appropriate way. But he's saying not through anger. That's not the way to deal with them, because you're shooting the messenger. Spiritually speaking, God is speaking to you and trying to get a message through to you, through this hardship, this difficulty. So when a person gets angry, and when a person loses their temper with another person, they're basically saying that God isn't involved in this process, i.e. God's gone, we're now involved in idol worship. And even though a person could hit you or curse you out of their free will, we're saying they still have free will. Why they were chosen for this particular act, I don't know. Right? Why God put that particular driver in front of you at that moment, I don't know. Right? They don't even know you, may not be deliberate, but your anger is denying the fact that you're meant to be believing this happened for a purpose. And it's something I can learn from this moment, which supposedly should help us from losing, God willing, our tempers. As Fas MS says, what is the remedy for the troubles that we've been having recently and historically? And he says, since through needless basis hatred, the temple was destroyed, he says, the same way, Shalidei Avas Yisrael, by loving other people, so too the temple will be rebuilt, ergo we will have ultimate peace among our people. May we see it in our days. We've come to the end of our presentation. Thank you all very, very much for attending. And may this be our last Shisha B'Av, God willing. Actually, we don't even need it. Maybe before then. Thank you,
Daniel. Thank you very much. Thank you to Rabbi Hashov. I think Danielle has a couple announcements.
Questions.
We'll take them afterwards because I know people have to run.
So special thank you to Rabbi Hadjiav. I think we can understand now why the Stern seniors voted him as Professor of the Year in Judaic Studies. Few years back, I think, well-deserved another round. And some logistical notes, if you weren't able to sign in, it'd be great just to know who was here, and we'll have the lecture available on YU Torah, so I'll send an email around. Keep apprised of our fall lecture series. We'll let you know when those speakers are signed up and on board for the fall. We'll have three coming up at that time. And a big announcement for our homecoming, September 18th, Sunday, September 18th, if you want to mark your calendars. It'll be on the Wilf campus. So I'm looking forward to hosting you guys back on campus there. Thank you again. Special thank you to you and to Yoni for, of course, having us here today.
And we'll keep leading up questions, but we have to take any questions, yeah.